Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another Adult Improver edition of Perpetual Chess. Regular listeners hopefully know that this is when we take a break from interviewing grandmasters and authors and talk to someone who's made significant progress in chess as a hobby. And our guest today is a 28-year-old applied mathematics graduate student, but has made amazing progress in his chess as a hobby. He has brought his Lee Chess rapid reading up to over 2,300. Been a slow and steady climb over an eight-year span. His Lee Chess Blitz rating is also over 2,100, and he's got some results IRL against some titled players as well. Of course, the IRL chess has been on the back burner due to COVID, but the climb continues, and I'm eager to welcome him to the show and discuss his life and his chess progress. So Michael Franco, aka Knows Knows All on Lee Chess, thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited. So, Michael, you've got an unusual background in that you got into chess due to some medical issues. So could you sort of walk us through the beginnings of how it is that you stumbled into the chess universe?
Sure. So technically, as a tiny kid, my grandmother actually introduced me to chess, but never really got into it too much as a kid. I might have played a little bit at like school, but never really actually got to play a scholastic tournament or anything like that. So fast forward to my senior year of undergraduate, and I actually ended up getting diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And so suddenly I was quarantined from the rest of the world because I had a compromised immune system. And I was struggling to basically stay focused due to chemotherapy treatment. And suddenly my entire world has shifted. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I need to find something productive to do because I have to stay sane. And that's exactly how I found chess, basically. I remembered, all right, I'm a math person. Maybe chess is something that I could be interested in. And this was 2013, just around the time that Magnus Carlsen was challenging Anand for the World Chess Championship. And I found Chess Network, not streaming at the time, but the YouTube recaps of this tournament. And I was hooked, basically. It was a great hobby to do when I was feeling down. Basically, I could always stay focused enough to just basically enjoy chess and maybe slightly in the beginning improve.
Improve a lot over time. But I'm curious because I feel like, you know, the main draw of chess, I've always felt this way as well, but I've really learned it more as a podcast host, is the game is the most appealing part of the game. You know, everyone, we might be chess fans. We might like watching the top players play. We might be able to appreciate a certain beautiful move. But you think even more so than some other sports, there's no substitute for playing. And I think that's especially true at the club level, because the world's best players are so good that it's hard to appreciate. Like watching Magnus play chess is not the same thing as watching like Roger Federer play tennis or something like that. Like you can see the physical marvel of Roger Federer, but with Magnus playing another elite player, the level that they're playing on is so strong that you need a lot of help. One needs a lot of help, myself included, to follow what's going on. So it's interesting to me that you came into chess not just interested in the game, but right away drawn to sort of the spectacle. So what is it, Michael, do you think about the World Championship match in 2013 that piqued your interest?
Well, I think one thing that was super interesting to me was that the number one player of quote unquote all time, I didn't really know much, but I would still agree with that. He was not the world champion. So at first I was interested that there's the storyline of, I won't call him the underdog because he was the higher rated player by a significant margin. But this person who had never been champion before suddenly challenging the throne, and he was coming in with like this huge tour de force rating, and his play was impressive. And I basically, the way that Jerry, aka Chess Network, kept breaking down the ideas that Magnus was coming up with, I was just perpetually impressed. Like at every single stage of every single game, I was always like, wow, this is great. So I came into chess definitely as a fan of Magnus, just based on Chess Network's commentary.
Yeah, and I think most listeners are probably familiar with Chess Network's hugely popular YouTube channel, and as Michael alludes to, been at it for a long time. So he's got videos for all levels for anyone interested. And hearing you discuss like sort of the appeal of Magnus, so was it the style of play, or was it the fact that he's young and maybe a little more relatable, or just like the dominance? What do you think it was that made him appeal to you first, Michael?
Yeah, definitely his style of play was super interesting to me. I will say it's probably because I was a newer player at the time. Imagine, I think my first ratings were around like 1100 Lee Chess. So I basically didn't know too much. And I knew that, quote unquote, I was bad at tactics, because I was bad at tactics. And yet here was Magnus Carlsen completely demolishing one of the best players of all time and, quote unquote, never using tactics. Now, obviously, that's not actually true, but to kind of a superficial level of what an 1100 version of me was understanding, I was like very impressed that you could basically play chess without actually trying to like murder the other guy on the board, but instead just calmly build up these positional victories little by little.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like Jerry did a good job explaining Magnus's style to you, because obviously it rings true to this day. I mean, of course he has some amazing tactics in his library of games, but certainly not what he's known best for. And of course, we'll get to your improvement in a minute, Michael. That's going to be sort of the main topic of this interview. But I'm curious, as the years have gone on, if like your fandom for Magnus persists, Magnus in particular, and B, if you still follow top level chess, on a regular basis.
Yeah, I will definitely say that I followed all of the candidates tournaments and the world championships since 2013, when I first got into it. And then, of course, because I have been reading a lot of books and stuff, I've also gone back in time. I've checked out Tall's games. I've checked out Karpov's games, Kasparov, etc. I won't follow live, basically, any of the other tournaments, usually due to time constraints. But there's a lot of really good recap videos out there. Power Play Chess, in particular, is a YouTube channel that I very much enjoy his recaps of the top level games. So I'm kind of, I'm occasionally following them, but I'm not like sitting there waiting for the players to finish their classical games and kind of analyzing in detail. It's just more of a hobby. As to the Magnus question, yes, I definitely still am a huge Magnus fanboy. I will say that 2013, 14, 15, 16, and then like even 17 Magnus felt like what Karpov could have been if he had like a little bit more engines. And so I was always like very impressed. And this was around the time that I was starting to improve. So I kept being impressed by Magnus. But then fast forward to 2019 Magnus, and he just suddenly becomes Kasparov. And I don't understand how someone can do that even now, but it's just amazing to me, basically, how he was literally able to change his style completely on its head. And then also, by the way, reach his top rating of all time again. So I love that about him. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I wouldn't quite compare it to Kasparov, like, because the thing is, he still has the whole toolkit from before too.
Sure.
But it's just like, yeah, something about AlphaZero, I think, and studying with the new engines sort of unleashed a whole new wave of creativity. And I like all the players, and of course, as a podcast host, I have to at least pretend to be neutral, but I do have a special affinity for Magnus. How do you feel about his chances against Nepo?
Yeah, I definitely think that he is the favorite. I will say that if the position gets nonsensical, Nepo might be able to take a game off of him. But I don't know, 2019 Magnus, if he shows up, I don't think he can beat.
Yeah, as we record this on September 29th, this won't be out for a couple of weeks, but the Meltwater Championship is ongoing, the Champions Chess Tour final round, and he's coming off a high in Norway chess. He seems to be peaking at the right time, but we'll see what happens. Nepo is certainly a formidable opponent.
Yeah.
But we'll leave it there on the global chess, elite chess landscape. Of course, as the world championship comes closer here on Perpetual Chess, there will be more coverage forthcoming, as well as during the world championship. So certainly looking forward to that. But this is an adult improver episode. So Michael, you're about 1100 in fairly short order. And we should say this is 1100 elite chess. So it's a bit of a pain constantly translating ratings, but for anyone listening, that's probably more like under 1,000 if you have a USCF rating or something like that. I mean, it basically means like you're probably hanging a piece every fourth game or something.
Sure.
You think
no,
at the beginning, Michael?
Much, much more than every fourth game. I was for sure hanging a piece basically every game, I would say, at that point.
Okay. And then the journey begins. So what happened? How did you slowly hang fewer pieces?
Yeah, that is definitely the biggest skill that I have gained from 1100 to 2300. I would say that it started with me listening to the advice that I kept hearing from people, which was chess is 99% tactics. And so I had a tactics app that I would kind of do on my downtime. I had graduated from undergrad, and I was working for a little bit there while I was basically, the treatment lasted several years technically, but it was really only 8 months where I was like out of it. So for kind of those several years, I was slowly getting better at chess, as well as kind of like getting into the working world as well. I would say a lot of tactics during that time. I wasn't really improving by analyzing my own games because I wasn't playing any games worth analyzing. And I really had no connection to any communities or anything, because at the time, kind of in my own little bubble, didn't have things like Discord. Twitch was the Twitch chess scene. I mean, the chess bras kind of started around then, but they weren't quite there. So there really was no live chess. You couldn't talk to anyone. So I was basically in my own bubble, saw a couple YouTube videos, and just basically kept playing while focusing on not hanging pieces and then trying to recreate the tactics that I was doing in like the side. But yeah, the beginning was definitely quite slow. I would say I did not improve very quickly at all for several years.
Okay. But like you said, 99% tactics. So mainly you feel like if you were to look at your games and try to discern a lesson from it, it would be like, don't hang a piece, basically.
Yeah. It was don't hang a piece. And then also, why aren't you developing? Why aren't you controlling the center?
Yeah.
Just kind of the basic things. A friend of mine actually had given me the book, a first book of Morphy. Actually,
and been name checking that one a lot lately. Go on.
And while I read the material, I didn't have a chessboard, so I couldn't actually go through the book, and I couldn't also visualize. So I kind of was struggling to actually see what was even happening on the chessboard. But I did read at least the like key takeaways of every single game, which is control the center, develop your pieces as soon as possible, make threats, et cetera, that like Morphy showed us how to do. So that I would say it helped me a little bit, but I was still even too early in my chess development to really appreciate what I was being taught by the book, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Morphy can help, especially like you say, with the development and the castling. He's not going to help you not hang your pieces. You know, that's kind of that you're on your own for that.
Definitely.
But yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned on a recent podcast, Neil Bruce has been recommending that book for a while, and it's definitely a good choice for someone who was in a similar situation to where you were. So you're grinding tactics and slowly starting to hang fewer pieces. And then you had mentioned in an email to me that eventually you started to read more books, and that's when you felt like your growth accelerated.
Yeah, I would say at some point in 2015 or 16, so this is now 2 to 3 years later, I'd been doing chess on and off. You know, it hadn't been anything that I was like 100% super committed and serious about. But I had read at that point Reassess Your Chess by Jeremy Silman, International Master Jeremy Silman. And the book is, it gets a lot of love hate from the community. Yeah. Personally, it was the first time that someone had basically laid out to me all of the positional ideas. And it was the first time that I started to actually understand like why Magnus was making these moves more than just this is the specifics of the position. It started to like give me basically a roadmap to how to understand positional chess. And I really did not have anything before that. You know, I'd seen some Chess Network videos and I'd heard him analyze his blitz games type of thing. But I was completely in my own bubble. So reading this book really helped me suddenly start to see that the goals of chess are not just tactics and don't hang pieces, but rather once you see something on the board, that it should then kind of clue you into what you should be thinking. So rather than you just always scrambling to find tactics, the board itself kind of helps shape your thoughts and tell you where you should
go. Okay. And yeah, and I of course did a podcast about Reassess Your Chess that listeners can check out. And overall, I'm a fan of it. Although there are a couple other books I probably like even more just because of the sheer, it's like overkill. There's so much information in Reassess Your Chess. But one thing that strikes me is I feel like a lot of the people reading it, they feel lost when they're playing. Like what I think it can help a lot with is they coming up with a plan. Like you don't know how to come up with a plan once you're like, okay, I develop my pieces and then what? And Silman with his list of imbalances is quite helpful in terms of like thinking about what to do next. But on the other hand, I feel like when you look at people's games from around that level, like say, you know, 1300 USCF, so maybe 1600 Lee Chess Rapid, something around that general level, it's still, they're not playing like Jeremy Silman, right? Like the games are still not, you know, like you can now diagnose a weak square or an isolated pawn or a backward pawn, and you might develop a mini plan to attack that pawn, and that gives you a feeling of confidence, which might help you manage your time better, but it's not the determining factor in the game. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So like, how do you balance sort of in looking back at what gave you the footing that has ultimately led you becoming a much stronger player? How do you balance sort of just it giving you confidence versus like it actually helping you play better?
Yeah. So definitely coming up with the plans was something that before reading that book, I had never even considered really doing. It was just, the rules of Morphy, if you will, try and attack at all costs type of thing. So even kind of appreciating that you can sit on a weak square and just chill with the knight on d5 and just say, great, I have a knight on d5. This is a monster. And what do you have? even kind of feeling that was something that I'd never done before. I agree. I was still occasionally, you know, hanging a piece or missing a tactic that would then kind of ruin the positional quote unquote masterpiece that I was trying to do. Huh. But basically formulating the thoughts in the correct way, and maybe correct might be a bit of a stretch, but at least, you know, in a correct way, helped. It's more than just a confidence thing. It's more of a like, here's an example. Once you have a passed pawn, previously, I would use the passed pawn probably to just distract someone and then maybe try and checkmate them. But once you kind of appreciate how a passed pawn can really just win the game by becoming a queen and force them back and back and back, and then you can checkmate them. Suddenly, right. This was something that I had never really considered before, and suddenly I'm becoming a better player. So it really was, I credit this book a lot in terms of just introducing me to this world before reading that book. And it took me almost a full year probably to read the book.
It's huge.
It is huge. Yeah. And go through a lot of the exercises with some friends, but basically it was before that I was confused. And after that, I at least had inklings of ideas that I should be considering that kind of made me feel both more comfortable and also like more directed.
Okay.
And so, yeah, then obviously the calculation level needed to then make that a reality was not there yet, but it was that was my first step. That was definitely a big first step for me. And really my rating actually did shoot up, I would say like 200 plus points.
Oh, wow.
After reading that book, or maybe just because of the year of chess.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have a follow-up on that, the aforementioned year of chess. But first, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by our longtime sponsors, our original sponsors, Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which utilizes spaced repetition to help you remember openings, tactical patterns, whatever it is that you're working on. They have a huge library of courses, including the free, short, and sweet versions of various openings. Speaking of openings, they just dropped Lifetime Repertoires, The London System by Grandmaster Lequang Liam. Love or hate The London, you got to know what to do against it, so be sure to take a look for that. And don't forget to sub to the How to Chess podcast hosted by yours truly. We just had Peter Sfidler on, other big guests in the works. So all the links you need are in the show description. Let's get back to talking chess.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are back. So Michael, as you had just mentioned, you read Reassess Your Chess and felt like it helped your game immensely. One thing I'm curious about is, okay, you're reading this, but you're also playing. I'm gathering from what you're saying that you were starting to reach the level where like some analysis of your game might be more beneficial. So what was your sort of approach to analyzing games during that period? Were you, and like what time control were you playing and stuff like that?
Yeah. So this was definitely around the time where I was playing a lot slower time controls. I had basically cut off all of my blitz play because, if I'm trying to kind of control a weak square or push a pass pawn, those things take a lot of effort and time. So I was really happy to play 15 plus 10 games mostly.
Good for you. Yeah.
And really basically focus on what went wrong. A lot of the time, what went wrong was I was missing tactics, I was missing threats, I was missing, you know, things that were actually ruining my plans. But I was also starting to see games where my opponent would mess up reasonably early, which would give me some huge positional advantage. And I would then actually be able to convert that into something that would be winning. So it was kind of the conversion process I had enough time to figure out. So
that must have been a good feeling.
It was a good feeling. And yeah. I was not quite at the level where I was creating the positional things and seeing it before it would happen. But I was at the level where if it did happen, I was capitalizing on it. So maybe I wouldn't understand how all the pawn structures could change. And I wouldn't understand specifically like, oh, this would be great for me if that happened. But then sometimes I would kind of walk into these, wait a second, that's a weak pawn. Or, oh, I know the d5 square is really important. And then I would be able to actually capitalize on it. So yeah, that was really nice. And this was also around the time where I started to take chess a lot more seriously because I'm reading this book and I'm starting to understand and I'm seeing my rating go up and I'm like, okay, let me actually put some effort into this. And I started reading more and I started playing more. And as you said, I started analyzing these games more. And around this point, I would say I was reaching roughly 2000 Lee Chess Rap.
Oh, that's big already.
Yeah. So definitely that book. And I, to be honest, I've reread it a couple of times over the years. I won't say it's my favorite book anymore, but I definitely will credit it with opening my eyes to what positional chess is.
Yeah. So obviously I've got to ask you what your favorite book is now,
sure.
But I wanted to highlight, I think you mentioned in an email to me that you've never had a coach, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's impressive. You just figured it all out on your own. But anyway, what's your favorite book?
Yeah. Back to the real question, right? It's a tough one. I don't really know if I have a favorite book. I will say that there have been some books that are extremely memorable to me. One of them was Igor Stahl's 50 chess, modern chess yeah. masterpieces. Right.
Yeah.
And that showed, I've read that one a lot more recently, but that one showed 50 games, I think from like 90 to 2002 or sometime around then. Of just basically top level games and what they were thinking and how they play. And those games, just from like a pure aesthetic perspective, were just like, oh, wow. Like if I could get to that level, talk about something that you could be proud of. Like any of those games were just unbelievable. So I really liked the sense of awe you could get from that game, from that book. And I also think he did a pretty good job of explaining like the thought processes. I'm not sure if I necessarily improved on the same level like I did from Reassessor Chess, but in terms of just like very memorable game after memorable game, just going through that was pure joy. Really, really fun.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've read it, but pretty detailed annotations. Mm-hmm. I would advise listeners. I think probably like 2000 Lee Chess Rapid on up, something like that, maybe slightly lower. It's a fairly advanced book. I just want to warn people.
Yeah, I would honestly say higher than that. I think okay. I was only reading it when I was 2100 Rapid at minimum, or maybe even more. And it was, there are definite parts where you just have to skip some of them because it goes too much into the weeds for my level at that time.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to, you know, a lot of Shirov games and stuff.
Sure.
So it's, yeah, it's just pieces flying all over the place.
Exactly.
Variation after variation. Yeah. Cool. Well, I mean, but I feel like already you've made big progress. So, and you mentioned it was a more concerted effort as you started to see some progress. So how much time a week, Michael, do you think you were spending on chess?
Yeah. So I started grad school and I joined the, I go to Berkeley for applied math PhD, and I joined the kind of the school chess club, which is different than the Berkeley chess club, which is kind of in the neighboring area. But the school's chess club was the first time I had met an international master before. And we were just like, oh, you're just a college kid. I'm a grad student. You're a college kid. You know, there's a pecking order apparently. And international master doesn't change it. But basically all of a sudden I'm talking to people about chess every Friday and they're crushing me in just like unbelievable ways. And I'm just like getting more and more experience of like how horribly you can get absolutely mopped off the board.
Right.
But after each game, they were analyzing with me and we would talk about the games. We would talk about like what went wrong. And more often than not, these players who are 2300 USCF or higher are basically like perfectly identifying exactly when I went wrong. And this started to give me more and more stuff. And so basically, in terms of how much time per week was I putting in, Friday, starting from 4 p.m. was the chess club. And I would basically play those games. I was at the level now where I could memorize the games that we had played. So then I would go back home, open up Lee Chess, plug in the analysis, and then see basically comparing my thoughts to their thoughts and seeing like, well, wait, they're always right about everything. And so this was taking, definitely my Fridays would be like a lot of chess. Occasionally during the work week, if you could call it that, as a grad student, it's hard to say the work week, but maybe 1 or 2 hours of playing per day, maybe that's a little bit high, but this was kind of what I was aspiring to. So 1 to 2 hours. And okay. then occasionally on like a Friday or Saturday, that kind of chess club jolt of energy would then push me to do like maybe 5 hours on a Friday or maybe like another 4 or 5 hours on a Saturday kind of thing.
Okay. So yeah. aggressive but not like unfathomable chess schedule, I would say. And were these games kind of rapid pace as well with the other kids from the Berklee Chess Club?
Yeah, I'd always ask for the longest time control possible because I'm the old man here.
Right.
But no, unfortunately, most of the time it was probably 5+3 would be like the longest I could get them to play. Maybe I'd play a 10+5 occasionally, but usually they'd just crush me in 5 minutes anyway, so it wouldn't change too much.
I mean, it shows a good attitude, a growth mindset that you were just like lapping it up and then analyzing the games afterwards.
Yeah, you definitely learn a lot from analyzing your own games, both with the engine, as long as you know what to look for, but then also kind of hearing their thoughts and when they say things like, oh, in this variation of the Richter Rouser, I was surprised you didn't play this. And I'm like, I didn't even know that was a move. Like, what do you mean I'm right. surprised by? So yeah, I mean, they obviously had more theory than me, but it started to actually not be the case because I would play the same people over and over again who are one of them, without maybe name dropping, because I haven't asked them if that's okay. But someone is a woman international master who is competing at the U.S. Women's Championship, and she would always play the French against me, and she would also, I was playing the French at the time, so she would play into my French, and we would get the poison pawn variation of the winnower. So these positions suddenly are just explosive, and everything is hanging, and I'm starting to learn like variations that are extremely detailed, but I'm also starting to understand what's happening at the end of the variation, which is something that I didn't like used to be able to do. But after playing a whole bunch of games against someone much higher rated and you see how you lose on both sides, suddenly you can start to improve that way. So yeah, that was really
useful. Yeah, it's great to play training games in your, or even casual games that you take seriously in your most frequently seen openings. And obviously in the computer age, you can do that against these various computers on Lee Chess and everywhere else. And Michael, hearing you talk about the French winnower and a couple of your most featured lines makes me wonder, what was your approach to openings generally? Were you studying them much?
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting journey where I've backpedaled completely. So on this point was maybe the first time, this is 2017, 18, somewhere around there. This was the first time that I was really starting to actually look at openings and start to memorize some ideas, maybe even like form my first repertoire. So I'm like 2000 Lee Chess and I would probably get taken out of book like very quickly. and I think that's pretty typical, honestly. But before that, I was playing things that would avoid tactics. That's what I was playing because I was scared of tactical positions. I was kind of following the Jeremy Silman, you know, everything's going to be an advantage. And the advantages that I understand are those that are static. And I didn't like IQPs and I didn't like positions where everything was exploding. And then around 2018, I realized that I needed to switch it up, basically. I realized that the reason that I kind of am scared about this stuff is because I have no experience in it. And so I switched from the Caro Kann, where I would try and play the most calm variations possible, to originally I started basically castling opposite in where white castled in the Caro Kann. But then it started to be where I was like, all right, well, let me play the French because they're very similar, but in the French, everything explodes. And so I'm going to get hurt if I don't understand what to do when the position is blowing up in my face. I started to play the Open Sicilian. I had been avoiding the Open Sicilian as an E4 player this whole time. And I started to say, okay, let me actually play into the Sicilian and let's see what happens. So I'm looking at lines, yes, but I'm actually, I think more than anything, it was like a mindset. Don't be afraid of the things you're not good at. And then afterwards, I would then basically play variation after variation against the computer from the game and see like, okay, this is what I was afraid of. What could have happened if we went into that? And then seeing the various ways that the computer would have destroyed my ideas. So that kind of helped a lot, basically get over a fear. And now I actually play the Sicilian as black. And I'm very happy when the position explodes as long as I have active pieces. So it's kind of that's been a big struggle where I flipped completely 180 from someone who always avoids scary stuff to now diving in, basically.
That's great. That inspiring. And again, shows sort of a growth mindset where you're just willing to sacrifice short term in order for longer term gain rings reminiscent of some advice that FM Peter Giannatos gave in our recent interview. And I know, Michael, you mentioned in our emails you played some tournaments. So what's going on with tournaments during all this? Are you playing them much?
So right around 2018, a friend of mine said, dude, you're 2100 Lee Chess, which according to the percentiles is like, you know, 90 something. He was like, you have to play one tournament. Like, this is insane. And I was like, I can't afford it. I'm a starving grad student who doesn't want to spend money to know that I'm going to get beat by some 10-year-olds. And he, you know, I'm in Berkeley. He's a Silicon Valley person. He said, listen, I'll pay for your first tournament.
Aw, that's nice.
And if you get any earnings, then you'll pay me back. So that was my first tournament. It was 2018. There was one kind of near where I lived. And it was actually a very big one based on what I found out about tournaments now. It was the Golden State Open, which has, I think, $50,000 of prize money, maybe like a little bit more than that. And I remember in this first tournament that I went to, Kostya Kavutsky was there, and I said hello to him and a couple of GMs that I had like heard about. Suddenly I'm just like seeing them chilling. So
yeah,
the very first tournament was intense because I was unrated and I was playing in the under 1800 section because I figured at least there, if I'm 2100 Lee Chess, maybe I'll be 1800. Over the board, and that was completely inaccurate. as an aside, I always hear people say that people who only play online chess don't adapt well to playing in person over the board chess. And actually, in my experience, it's very odd. I just wanted to throw this out there that I never had this issue at all. And the reason I never had this issue is because I actually would play chess on the physics simulator game Tabletop Simulator. Huh. And it's like a game where you're basically, you can do it in VR. I never had a VR thing, but you basically are like a third person kind of, it's a first person look at like a chessboard in 3D. And so you're moving the pieces, and there, it's not like Lee Chess where, you know, everything's 2D and you like make a move and it's all like legally checked according to everything. It's just like a physics simulator. So you can like flip the table and you can, you know, knock pieces around and you can just like make random things. So actually I credit
multiverse.
That. Yeah, exactly.
It's crazy.
I credit that game a lot with making my first tournament not at all bad. In fact, I felt very comfortable with the 3D world.
You're also playing at the club though, to be fair, right?
So at this point though, this was 2018. I had played at the club for 1 year. So
okay.
Yeah, this was at the beginning. Yeah, this was tough. I did okay in the tournament in that I think I went just below 50%. But I was not playing people that were 1800 and I was going just, below 50%. So that was a,
so you got a provisional of like 16 something or
exactly
or what?
Something around there. Then the next year, 2019, played the same tournament, did a lot better, basically, only lost one game due to my own, kind of getting in my own head, but otherwise I won or drew everything. And this was basically the last time that I was trying to play exclusively like Karpov. And right after that tournament, I looked at kind of what had happened and I analyzed all these games to death because they were really interesting games for once. And I realized, again, I was completely scared of when the positions would blow up, when there were several scenarios where if I had just allowed the position to blow up, I would have, like, it would have been so good for me. But I was like, oh no, I'm too scared. I can't allow that. So that's when I like completely changed my openings. And I completely said, like, mindset wise, I need to be comfortable in those positions if I want to be able to crash people like that. So, yeah, the tournaments were really nice, but it was really only two tournaments so far, in person. And then, there was a COVID online tournament, that I played, which was really interesting. Where I actually ended up getting a tournament performance rating of 2370, which was kind of insane. But I went 7.5 out of 9, and several of those players were 2000 over the board. And one of them was an international master, and I drew the international master. So that was, it was a fantastic tournament.
Amazing.
Yeah. I don't think I am 2370. That is definitely a fluke, but it this was after I had kind of changed my mindset, and it really did show. In fact, in the game against the IM, I sacked the exchange just completely without anything except for here's a full exchange, take it. It was the correct move, and I followed it up correctly. And then we reached an end game where I had a knight and two pawns against the rook, and there were a couple other pawns also on the board, and it ended up being a draw. So ultimately the correct decision, and it was very exciting to do that against someone like 600 points higher rated than me.
Yeah, that's great. All right, I have a few follow-ups. So
sure.
Number one, bringing it back to the US CF tournaments that you played, I know there's some online stuff trying to convert League Chess ratings to USCF/FIDE, which are, again, somewhat approximate, probably within 100 points, with USCF tending to be higher than FIDE. So based on your end of two and your sort of anecdotal observations, what do you think a 2100 FIDE rapid player, what do you think that does translate to? Like, do you think you played at your level in that first tournament, or do you think maybe your nerves got you a little bit and you underperformed? You got the 1600 performance rating.
Yeah, definitely my nerves were for sure a thing, because I've never been so focused for that long. So it was a little bit of nerves and it was a little bit of stamina. I definitely never played that much chess for that long. It was a 4-day tournament and I was like playing 7 hours a day and my heart could barely take it. Like I was just
focused. It's intense. Yeah.
So that was a lot of fun. Definitely would recommend. But definitely the nerves and the overall fact that this was my very first time, it was a struggle. So at that point, I was 2100 rapid. This was with the caveat that League Chess has changed the rapid ratings somewhat recently in 2021. So that probably would translate to something even higher now, I think. But I would say probably around 1700 if I had to guess. So not like that underperforming, but a little bit underperforming. I would also say that probably everyone says that they're underrated. So in that sense, maybe it's a little bit of personal bias, but yeah.
Okay. Interesting. And do you have any advice for anyone listening who's who's played a lot online, reached a decent level, and never played a tournament?
I would say you're not alone. I definitely, in that one tournament, met three other people who were unrated who also had played a lot of chess online for several years. And I mean, now we're post Queen's Gambit boom, so I'm sure that number has exponentially increased. But yeah, definitely you're not alone. Go for it. It's a lot of fun. I would strongly recommend that you bring extra food. This was something that I did not understand beforehand. And so I actually had to offer a couple of draws because I was just beat and tired and hungry. And that was not like my best chess. But yeah, bring a lot of food and just go for it, because even if you end up completely underperforming, and let's say you think you're 1700 and you get a 1200 rating, that doesn't define you, obviously, as a person. And secondly, it means that when you come back, you're going to get that feeling of increasing a lot of rating really quickly. And right, that's going to be true. Just as good as getting it on the first time around. So there's actually a lot less stress than what you put on yourself.
Okay. And another question, I mean, it's a cool story about your friend putting you in your first tournament because the cost was prohibitive, which is certainly understandable. Were you tempted to go for the section that sort of maximized your chances of winning a prize?
Right. Like if I had played the under 1200 or something.
Yeah. With no
technically, I think as an unrated person, there's a cap on how much you can get. And that's probably why. So people like me don't end up taking all the money. No, I don't think I was tempted, because if I'm only going to play one tournament a year, or at this point, one tournament ever, I wanted it to be games that I would be proud of and games that I could analyze and kind of improve on. So I wasn't really tempted to try and think about the money. I really was like, all right, let me put my best foot forwards and play people where I won't win necessarily.
Okay. All right. Well, it's been awesome hearing your tournament experiences. I want to hear about a few more chess books, and I want to hear about some of the Twitch modding you're doing. But first, Michael, we're going to take one more break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by chessmood.com. Chessmood is a subscription-based instructional website founded by Grandmaster Avtech Gregorian, who you can hear on episode 192 of Perpetual Chess. Founded by Avtech and his team of Grandmasters, there's a huge library of opening, middle game, and end game videos. There's special events like webinars, streams, one-on-one blitz games. Every Chess Mood member gets a consultation call with one of the Grandmaster coaches. And also be sure to check out Chess Mood's free content. Avtech has a great blog. They also have a YouTube channel where they're posting videos from Grandmasters daily. So links you need are in the show description, but be sure to check out chessmood.com. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. Aimchess, of course, collects your games from the major chess sites and then gives you an actionable study plan. So it's a great resource for players and coaches alike. It tells you how you compare to your rating peers in openings, end games, time management, all that stuff. It told me I was behind on the clock in 87% of my recent blitz games. I think I might need to work on that. And thanks to Aimchess for pointing that out. But it's a great product. Go to Aimchess and check it out. And if you decide to try out a subscription, use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. As always, the info you need is also in the show notes.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are back. And so, Michael, I wanted to follow up because, in our correspondence, you mentioned several other books. So I'm curious, like, you could bring it forward to sort of your current level. Like, what are you working on in your chess now? And what's sort of getting you excited right now?
Yeah, there's been a lot of chess books that I've been reading since COVID hit. My top ones that I've finished would include, I basically finished Pump Up Your Rating. That was a pretty good book.
Yeah.
Essential Chess Sacrifices was a really fun book also to kind of dig into, where it was, here's all the ways you can sacrifice on F7. Here's all the ways you can sacrifice on G7. Here's all the ways you can play Knight D5 as a piece sacrifice. And as I was kind of picking up the Sicilian, this was kind of a fun way to see, oh wait, all of these are open Sicilians. because that's just like where fun happens on the chessboard, if you will. And I have also been reading very currently, like the most recent book that I've been reading is Augard's GM Prep, Thinking Inside the Box. It's a little bit above my pay grade, but I've been doing it kind of with some friends. We've been working through the puzzles together, and the actual like advice he gives, not all of it even applies at all to my rating, because he's talking to someone who's going to be like a 13 or 14 year old pushing GM, and he's saying like, here are the thoughts you need to have on the opening, and I'm here just being like, I completely changed my repertoire just to kind of get a little bit more experience. So yeah, it's definitely above my pay grade, but it's really well written, and I really do like that book as well.
Yeah.
Let's see, there's a couple others for sure. I haven't done Woodpecker Method, but Pump Up Your Rating did talk about the Woodpecker Method, and I like that idea for sure. There was the book, let me recall, it was Sokolov. I'm trying to remember what his book was.
Middle Game something or other?
Yeah, exactly, like chess middle games. And then also the other one that was similar to that was Del Rio's Chess Structures, I think is what it was called.
Yeah, and Rios. Yeah, it's a great book.
That one was definitely... Oh, sorry, Flores Rios.
Yeah.
That was probably the best book on chess structure that I'd read, although I haven't really checked out Sam Shanklin's, which is also supposed to be quite good. So I've read a lot of books in the past 2 years, and I don't know exactly how much it's helped me. It's definitely opened my eyes to a lot. But in terms of like overall chess improvement, sometimes I'll say it's a little bit more entertainment than it is straight improvement. analyzing the games in particular, and analyzing your own serious games with higher rated opponents has probably brought me more actual improvement than most of those books.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to highlight, because I enjoy reading them as well. But, you know, I was just listening to James Altucher, of course, who's been on the podcast. He interviewed Judah Polgar. So definitely recommend listeners check for that podcast interview. And in it, you know, he asked Judith what she had done to improve the most. And she actually credited blindfold chess when she was a kid. But curiously, she also said, like, today she doesn't even feel like that's enough anymore because everyone's doing that sort of thing. But she was ahead of her time. But James did like a little recap after the interview, and he was saying, like, you know, doing the thing is the thing, basically. Like reading the books is one thing, but yeah, you know, as the cliche goes, if you're going to learn to swim, you don't read a book about swimming. You just have to get in the water and figure it out. So it's, you know, it's just kind of tricky to find the right balance. But then yeah, also hearing you talk about a woodpecker method and GM Axel Smith's works makes me wonder where tactics fits into all of this, because obviously a lot of the improvers I've interviewed are just doing tons of tactics, and you haven't really mentioned them that much yet. So
definitely I have been doing tactics, but the tactics that I've been focusing on are not the puzzle rush tactics, but rather the let's say chess tempo 2100 rated or higher tactics. So it's where you kind of have to sit there and you sit on your hands and you don't move for 45 minutes and you make sure that you've seen everything that can possibly happen, and you are completely comfortable that your, let's say, seven move calculation of like several different branches is like completely correct. So it's like, it's not tactics per se, as more like visualization and calculation. That's what I've been focusing on for the past, I would say, 2 years.
Okay. So it's not, you wouldn't say it's like what got you to where you are, but it's become increasingly important.
Yeah. Especially when I'm talking about the games where I'm playing people over the board, or the games where I'm playing people and you have, you know, sometimes I'll play a long, like a 30 plus 30 game online, and you have a lot of time there to really sit and really calculate. And if you think you see something, but it fails, like, you need to refute that early. And so, yeah, being able to kind of calculate, not so much far, but accurately, is definitely a skill that I've been working on.
Yeah. And that again echoes good advice that Peter Giannatos gave on the podcast about solving challenging problems. I mean, he was just saying 5 to 10 minutes. So 45 minutes is all the more impressive. So I think more, even though like I interview a lot of people about their sort of Lee Chess Rapid and classical ratings, I don't play a lot. So I have more grounding in the fact that your blitz rating was like 2140 or whatever at the time of this interview. So what is your USCF after, like, considering you barely played? So what is your USCF at this moment, Michael?
Yeah, so my USCF is still the same rating it was, basically. So I've played only two tournaments, the first one 3 years ago, the next one 2.5 years ago. So it's still, I think, just under 1700, just around 1700. And I believe that means it's still provisional. I don't quite know the rules there. But then
I should say, actually, because, sorry, you can finish what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah, so technically that I've played two tournaments since that are like USCF online rated ones. And right, so my online rating is probably like 1950 or 1960 or something like that. But, you know, it's not quite the same as the other rating.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So a couple of things. So provisional ratings, that I'm 90% sure it's based on 25 games. And for anyone listening who doesn't know how they work, basically, in order to get a rating that fluctuates less, the first few tournaments you play, if you beat someone, they add 400 points to the rating of the person you play, and that gets inputted. If you lose to someone, they subtract 400 points, and that gets inputted. And if you draw, you input their rating. So, you know, if you played 3 1600s and won one, lost one, and drew one, you'd be a 1600, just to give the most basic example. But of course, that means that your initial rating is going to be very subject to the ratings of the people you play. If you play a 2500, it's automatically going to pull up your performance rating, even if you lose. And if you play a 900, it's automatically going to pull down your performance rating, even if you win. So after 25 games, you get an established rating, and then it's just like plus or minus 15 points or 20 points or depending on what the rating difference is. So that's just a bit of background for anyone wondering. And I also just wanted to highlight the fact that hearing Michael talk about like how strong he is, and he's rated 1700 for anyone who's been playing tournaments here as the quarantine sort of ends, as COVID sort of maybe ends, like anyone getting frustrated with their results, like this is what you're dealing with. You know, there's people like Michael that have just been grinding for many, many hours and making amazing progress, as well as the kids whose ratings can't keep up. So keep your head up if you're out there trying and losing to all these lower rated people. It's crazy. Yeah. So do you have any current tournaments planned, Michael?
I would love to play in January, which is, you know, looking forward quite a bit, the same tournament that I played those years ago. So I don't know if I would do it, specifically because COVID still kind of gets me a little nervous. So I haven't fully gotten over it in order to like get out into the world yet. But assuming things are better than they are now, that would be definitely a tournament I would love to do, because it's local. There's a lot of stiff competition. And I think for once I could actually, I don't know, win or something, the under 1800.
Yeah.
maybe I'll just play up a section. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So a tempting choice, I'm sure. And are you still managing to spend a lot of time on your chess right now? I mean, I'm sure like your grad work in applied mathematics is fairly demanding.
Yeah. So especially recently, I've been trying my best not to focus 100% on chess, and definitely I'm trying to graduate in a year. So I'm really thinking thesis work, research, math, etc. But yes, I would say at night, I'm still able to kind of read for 2 hours or so, a chess book, or 1 to 2 hours of a chess book, and kind of end the day. Maybe not like as a bedtime story, but like I'll put in 1 to 2 hours of serious thought and then cool off with either some, you know, nothing blitz, or just like watching some streams or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you've been a mod for I Am Andras Toth's stream, you mentioned.
Yeah, definitely become a big part of the online chess community in a lot of different ways. Obviously, there's a bunch of different communities, but Andras has a Twitch channel, and I'm a mod there. He and I, while he's not given me direct coaching, he has been an inspiration, and we've talked a lot about my chess, and he was one of those people that convinced me to basically just pick up the Open Sicilian and just go for it, because cool. No one knows any theory, and it's a lot of fun, and you'll learn. So yeah, he's been really nice about that. I'm a big follower of the Chess Bros for sure, and in fact I'm going on their trip to Tulum, Mexico.
Wow, I didn't know that was happening. That's gonna be nuts.
Yeah, it's gonna be fun. they've got like a chess camp during the day, and then it's Tulum, Mexico at night, so we'll see what happens there. And then I'm a moderator of a couple of chess discords. The Morphe Chess Club is kind of the big one, and also active in a couple other ones that I'm not a moderator of. And just having these communities where you can send people your games, you can analyze each other's games, you can talk through a chess book together online while like going through it simultaneously, so you like have a community. I think it's definitely helped my chess personally a lot to basically have people that you're working with, whether or not their your rating is kind of not so important. Definitely helps to have people higher than you, but also if you're, you know, working with someone, let's say 400 points lower rated than you, the act of teaching an idea really cements it in your own personal experience. I've learned that from just like teaching in general.
Yeah.
And so it's very true in chess as well. It helps to teach.
Yeah. Yeah. That harkens again back to James Altucher's plus minus equal, which Jesse Cry also did a video about. So listeners,
right,
should check for that. But basically that's the idea, is that you learn more from teaching in addition to playing. So before we let you go, Michael, this has been some amazing tips, and it's really inspiring to hear of your progress. But we do have one math related Patreon mailbag question. So this is from friend and supporter of the podcast, Matt Elliott. And Matt asks if you feel that your mathematical background has helped your chess game. In particular, have you studied graph theory? If so, do you feel it has helped your chess? And you should explain what graph theory is, like you did to me before we were recording.
So I don't know if my math experience in particular has helped with my chess. You could argue that there are parts of math where you definitely have to visualize kind of where you want to go. And there's certainly a logic to proofs that would be very similar to the logic you use when you're kind of refuting a variation that you're trying to consider over the board. So in that sense, yes, they are similar. And the reason I started chess during my original self-quarantine was I thought I liked math, and don't math people like chess? Like, I had heard that, so I looked into it. Spoiler alert, it seems yes, in fact, I do.
sounds like you're more convinced about chess than math, the way you phrased that sentence. So,
in that sense, yes, they're related. In terms of like true math knowledge, like graph theory is kind of the understanding of the analysis of networks. And so the only real network that I would see in kind of chess would be all the move variations. You kind of start in your current position. There's, let's say, five different moves that you're going to be considering, and that branches, and each of those will branch a couple. And that forms a graph. You can think of each position as a node, and you can think of the lines between them as moves that you're making. And so if you're going to analyze something in graph theory, I would say that probably, at least to me, the research level mathematician in me is going to be looking at the problem completely differently than anything that you would really consider in, like, let's say you're over the board and you're calculating these actual variations. So it's like, in theory, they're similar, but in practice, I would say they're completely different ideas of how to approach chess versus math with graph theory in particular.
Okay. And more broadly, I think you mentioned you have 1 year left in your sort of current degree. Like, what's going on with your career? I know the academic track can be brutal. It can be
true.
Quite competitive. So what do you have to do to graduate? And then what's next to finish your current degree, I should say. And what's next after that?
Yeah. So I have, this is my sixth year. I've got some publications for sure, and I'm trying to basically flesh out and publish this one final idea, which I'm currently working on. I won't really explain it because it would take too long to kind of get through the background, but suffice to say it's about fluid dynamics and applied mathematics.
Wow.
And so if I can kind of finish that reasonably quickly and then put together all of my work into kind of a coherent thesis, then that would be maybe like a 150 to 200 page kind of article of like, here's all the work I've gone through in math. And that would be hopefully done by, let's say, next May, and then I could graduate. Technically, in terms of career, I'm not thinking pure academia. I really love teaching. And in fact, I really like teaching chess as well. Not so much as a coach, but just it's really fun to kind of like write articles and write studies on Lee Chess that kind of explain concepts.
Oh, yeah, which you've done a bunch of, right?
Yeah. Some of mine have been on the staff picks, which is really nice. but basically, I would say I'm kind of in the realm of I want to go to one of the national laboratories and do research there for they have bunch of different labs in the US and a bunch of different people working on a bunch of really different interesting problems that are, I would say, engineering in nature, but you need an applied mathematician on the team to kind of understand some of the dynamics of the engineering problem. So that's okay. Kind of where I'm hoping to go, which is not pure academia.
Okay. Man, heady stuff. Well, good luck. sounds like you're in the home stretch of sort of an important phase.
Yeah, which is why I said I'm trying to lean off the chess a little bit, and that's why tournaments aren't my main focus. But yeah.
Well, the beauty of chess is that it will always be there. So in wrapping up, Michael, I feel like you should give a more explicit shout out, detailed shout out to that Discord, because I'm sure if there's room for more, I'm sure some people would be interested. I agree with what you've said about community being really important. And then just to start brainstorming while you're saying that, I'm going to ask you for sort of three takeaways, the three things people should do to improve their chess game.
Sure. So that Discord is the Morphe Chess Club. You can find it on disbord.org. I know that's one of the main places that you can find Discords, and we're probably one of the bigger chess ones. So if you search chess
I'll link to that. Yeah,
sure. Let's see. In terms of the three takeaways, the main one is definitely play longer, serious games and really analyze them afterwards with an engine, by yourself, with other people. Everything you can do to analyze your own play is going to be really useful, not so much because you're going to be expanding like your opening knowledge, but because you'll see the types of mistakes you're making. And if you can kind of think a little bit bigger than just every single game and think about all the games, then you'll start to maybe make some conclusions on what you can improve on. So for me in particular, that was me realizing I was playing scared. I was always scared of positions opening up. That's definitely the biggest one. Three takeaways. Number two, I would probably say would be playing higher rated people. At Berkeley, it's been a lot of fun to play better people than me by a lot, like not even close to my level. And, when you hear their thoughts, I guess it goes back to analyzing your own games, but when you hear their thoughts, they have some really interesting things to say. And so talking to your opponents, both online and in person, has been something that I really like. Maybe that's similar to analyzing, but I'll put that as number two.
Yeah, that's good.
And then number three, at least for me, I'll put it as enjoying the game is sometimes more than just improving my own play. And so that's why I really like reading the chess books. And that's why I really like kind of going back in history and seeing games from Tal and seeing games from Fischer. My 60 Memorable Games was like a really good book, not because I probably improved a lot by reading it, but because these were some monumental figures in chess. And it's always interesting to kind of see their history. So getting a feel for the overall scene for me brings so much enjoyment that it kind of keeps a passion for chess running the entire time. So then when I have to do something I don't want to do, like memorize a whole bunch of moves of some opening in the Nidorf or something, you can keep the passion because you know its place.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, this has been amazing. So many actionable recommendations, book recommendations. It's great to see. It's awesome. Also, I mean, I feel like we barely even spent time on the sort of chess as an escape for medical issues. It's awesome that like you were able to grab onto it at that moment and that your interest has sustained.
Yeah. It started off as kind of something to keep me distracted, but definitely blossomed into much more than that, I would say, at this point, for sure.
Yeah. And the health, you're good to go now?
Completely good. 2.5 years of chemo. As I said, most of it was hardcore in the very, very beginning, like for a couple months there. I've been fine for, I guess now, 7 years of no chemo. So things
awesome.
Are pretty good.
It's great to hear. All right. And knows all on Lee Chess. Michael, if anyone wants to reach you another way, is there another way or should they just message you on Lee Chess?
Yeah, messaging me on Lee Chess would definitely be the best way. Knows all for sure.
Okay, awesome. Well, keep up the good work. I hope you're able to continue to find time for chess despite all your other achievements, Michael. It's been fun to hear about it.
Yeah, hopefully. Looking forward to it.
Thank you to everyone who listens to and supports the podcast. And most of all, thank you to my producer, Matthew Passy. Be sure to check us out on social media. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFischel1. We also have a Perpetual Chess Facebook group where we continue the conversation about each episode. I've even got the Instagram page locked and loaded, actually posting clips every week. So you can follow at Perpetual Chess to catch some clips there. I also want to thank our sponsors, of course, Chessable.com, the original sponsor of Perpetual Chess, Aim Chess, Chess Mood. Thanks. I'm proud to be affiliated with all of these sites. Also want to thank Blue Wire Podcast, with whom I partner. Big shout out to Blue Wire. Check them out for sports podcasts. But most of all, I want to thank the individuals who helped make Perpetual Chess go via PayPal or Patreon. And of course, they get to find out the guests, send in questions, hear occasional GM lectures on Zoom, and even get ad-free podcasts. So thank you all for supporting Perpetual Chess and keeping it going.
So without further ado, I would like to give special thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, shout out to JB, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprentice Twitch channel, Aniti Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, I am Dimitri Schneider, Douglas Wilson, I am Eric Rosen, Farhan Thawar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Hampus Axelson, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nilsson, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin Gilmore, Kevin O'Callaghan, Kevin Pryor, King's Celt, King's Crusher YouTube channel, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnace Twitch channel, Peter McManus, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Soddy, Philip Vlummens, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Ray Lillywhite, Reuven Fisher, Robert Hansen, Ross Crossland, Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, the Vintage Patzers, which is a Chess.com improver group, and Wayne Beam. I would also like to give thanks to East Viega, Adam Fowler, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio Leonfort, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brandon Halseed, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Ken Kabadai, Chad Hilton, Chad Likens of Rose City Chess in Portland, Oregon, Chess for Charity in Jacksonville, Chess Patzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Caros, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Best, Dave Saylor, David Blaskoczek, David Brown, David Goris, David Hamblin, David Cramley, David Peterson, Dennis Parrish, FM, Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Melo Perilla, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Frank Tortoris, MD, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Foote, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Gregory Higgins, Han Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jay Tuttle, J.D. Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse Damas, DeCumus, excuse me, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Jim Sadler, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almaguer, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Bannister, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Justin Goodfeller, Jen Shahadi, Joe Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky of Chess Dojo, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Ryforth, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emelyanova, a.k.a. Photo Chess, Mark Chaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matt Ferrari, Matthew Allen Coughlin, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, the Mechanics Institute of San Francisco, Michael Ollard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Negmat Milijanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, Pablo Davila, Grandmaster Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Eckert, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited of Switzerland, Randall Montgomery, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Turner, Robert Wall, Robert Wilson, Rory Coleman, Ryan Berg, Samson Teaches Chess, Satyajit Malugu, The Safe Chess Publishing, Unstoppable Empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Sergey McCaggan, Seth Ruzica, Seth Will, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Simon Schmidt, Stefan Roller, Stephen Miller, and Tom George, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Terry King, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Beauchamp, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. So thanks for listening, everyone. We will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.